So I'm talking today about mindfulness and its place within the Buddhist path. We're looking at mindfulness as one of the five spiritual faculties, the five aspects of our experience. But I'm actually not going to use that framework to talk about mindfulness today. I'm going to be talking about it in terms of the most basic formulation of the Buddhist path, which is ethics. And so we'll be talking about what Buddhist ethics means, meditation, and wisdom or insight. And one reason I'm doing this particular talk today is I actually gave pretty much the same talk on Sunday when I was at an event called the How the Light Gets In Festival in Heian-wai, a festival of philosophy and ideas. And the reason that I've been asked to talk about mindfulness and ethics, and the reason I've been asked to talk about that subject is that mindfulness has become, well, everyone tells me it's a buzzword, which after 2,500 years isn't bad to be the cutting edge thing. It's, you know, there was a great interest in mindfulness, the subject of mindfulness at the festival. There were, you know, obviously the people who go along are sort of intellectuals of various sorts. But yeah, really a lot of interest and engagement and discussion and some controversy as well. And it's interesting to reflect why mindfulness has become so popular. I won't talk about that very much now because I think that's another talk. But clearly, it's in a world that's speeding up, there's something very attractive and actually quite important for people experientially about learning to slow down a bit. In a world where there's an overflow of information, it's very important to be able to manage our attention. In a world where there's more and more a sense of stress and actually rising levels of things like anxiety and depression, those sorts of things, well, it's more and more important to have ways to engage with our mind, not just conceptually, but experientially. And it turns out that the Buddhist tradition has things to offer. So that's why all of this interest in mindfulness has burgeoned. And personally, I think this is very, very positive. But there are questions around it. It does raise some issues because mindfulness has been plucked out of the Buddhist tradition, taken out of the Buddhist tradition in quite a general sort of way, and then it's been integrated with lots of other things like cognitive therapy. So I teach mindfulness-based cognitive therapy courses. I mean, actually, they're mindfulness courses, but there's an element of cognitive therapy. So, and then mindfulness is used in a variety of ways, some of which have become controversial. When big companies like Google take on mindfulness, then it has a meaning for them. I'm criticizing it, actually. But that meaning is about the context that they create with, and, you know, what their values as a company. So they have this big program called Search Inside Yourself, not just search the internet for things you need. Search inside yourself. And you do that not with an algorithm or a program. You do that with mindfulness. So search inside yourself. But of course that raises all sorts of questions. You know, has the meaning been changed? And is mindfulness something that's really kind of value-free, you know, that doesn't imply any particular way of acting, any sense of what's right or wrong? You can maybe be a mindful mass murderer. Could you? Maybe. Actually, I'm sorry to say, there are some examples of this, of meditators who, you know, committed atrocities fairly recently. I mean, actually, you go back a little bit further, in the Rinzai Zen tradition of Japan, you've got the figure of the samurai. I must say, I really love those old Kurosawa films of the Seven Samurai and that sense of dignity and ability. And they practice meditation. You know, they practice mindfulness. And, you know, maybe we can have sort of accept them in a romantic sort of way as figures of the past. But they were also, once the Meiji regime came along, those same samurai became the drivers of what led to World War II and Pearl Harbor and all that. And you can read the history of it. So, you know, actually it seems that you can practice some of these things, mindfulness, for example, and you put them in a certain framework and they aren't necessarily going to make you someone who acts in a way that I personally would consider to be ethical. And that's worth thinking about. You know, those are extreme cases, but in our own lives, the fact that we meditate can mean all sorts of things to us. It can be a way to block out all those irritating people who bug us, for example. Get away and have some sense of peace. It can be a subtle way of avoiding acting. It's possible to use meditation and mindfulness, which are different things, actually. That's one of the important distinctions we need to talk about. It's possible to use them in different ways. So really the question is how we approach these practices. Practice is just a kind of technique. Any practice is a technique. Meditation is just a repository of techniques. And techniques can be used in any way. Mindfulness is a bit more subtle than that, because it's not just a technique. It's about being aware, but most importantly, it's about how we're aware. So I think I said a couple of weeks ago that mindfulness isn't just paying attention. You know, it's not just attention training and learning to focus and be concentrated. There is a word for that in Buddhism, which is manasikara or manasikara, which is the capacity which is the faculty of attention. And manasikara is kind of ethically neutral within Buddhist psychology. But mindfulness isn't really. Mindfulness is about paying attention in a particular sort of way. It connotes a kind of sensitivity, awareness to one's own thoughts and feelings, awareness to the thoughts and feelings of other people, awareness of the consequence of one's actions. So mindfulness really needs that context. And I want to talk about that context in relation to this basic formulation of the Buddhist path that I've talked about, which is ethics, meditation, and wisdom. So Sangharakshita says that one of the ways he describes a similar sort of issue is, he said, well, there's the path of regular steps and the path of irregular steps. Now, most people in the West, you know, concurrently, but actually really for quite a long time, have been attracted to meditation first and foremost attracted to Buddhism because we're interested in meditation. We tend to identify Buddhism with the practice of meditation. But actually, that's starting in the middle, according to the traditional Buddhist way of looking at it. So Sangharakshita says, well, you know, maybe that's all right. It's a path of irregular steps. It's two steps forward, and then you've got to go back one. That happens. So we start off on the path of irregular steps. Some people come to practice of or interest in Buddhism because they take drugs, shocking, and have cosmic experiences where they've gone actually something like 10 steps ahead. But Sangharakshita Professor's point is whatever, however irregular the path we start off on, we've got to go back to the beginning. Yeah, and we've got to know what the beginning really is for us. So mindfulness has its own kind of way of, as a popular movement and as a therapy and so on, it does take us back to a certain kind of beginning, which is really just looking quite directly at our experience and learning to calm down and things like that. But there's another way of thinking about the beginning, which really is very important within Buddhism, and that's the realm of ethics, our behaviour, how we act in the world, how we impact on the world, how we impact on other people. And ethics is a problematic word. When I was 13, I had a Jewish upbringing, and I, however, I was what one of my friends calls brought up in the Freudian sect of Judaism, which is to say that my father was influenced by Freud, and the Judaism was a little bit superficial for us. I mean, not in itself, but just in my experience. But I, when you're 13, if you're a Jewish boy, you have a bar mitzvah. And I had a bar mitzvah. So, mazel tov. On a bar mitzvah, you read out a section of the Bible, which is part of what we call the Torah. That's the first five books of the Bible. And my portion, and in the Jewish synagogue, you cycle through the whole Torah over a three-year period. Yeah, basically, you start at the beginning, you work your way through, and then you're back at the beginning, something like that, anyway. So, and it's a responsibility of a Jewish man, or in Reformed Judaism, women do this as well, but it's a responsibility of the community to read out those sacred words, okay? So when you're 13, you take your responsibility as a member of the community by doing your bit in that process. In other words, you're given this week's portion of the Torah to read out. So my portion was the Ten Commandments, which I will not tell you in Hebrew now, but you read them out in Hebrew. And so I spent a period of time studying with the rabbi, going through the Ten Commandments in great detail and, you know, learning the Hebrew and everything. And my rabbi is a very trendy rabbi. He wore, or at least he was, by the standards of rabbis, he was very trendy. That's probably setting the bar rather low. But he wore green socks, and in the 1950s, he'd been a teddy boy. In Manchester, maybe the 1960s, I'm not sure. Anyway, he was considered a bit out there. Also, he was very interested in Carl Jung, and he'd give sermons where he would give Jungian interpretations of various bits of the Torah. So he was very open-minded, in a way, and but we were nonetheless studying the Ten Commandments. And his radical idea, and this in a Jewish context, this is incredibly radical. He got me and the girl that we were also studying along with me to write little essays about what we were studying. So I had to write an essay on why we need commandments, and because of my upbringing, which was sort of socialist and liberal and all that sort of stuff, I wrote an essay, being a rather precocious little boy, saying, well, I don't think we do need commandments. I think we should take responsibility for ourselves. And, I was a clever little boy, and it was probably a well-written essay. So I gave it to the rabbi, and afterwards he gave it back to me and said, It's a very good essay, Simon. Let's get back to studying the Ten Commandments now. So, anyway, that's just a little story about how ethics is problematic in our society. It was problematic for me. Actually, I was 13 when I was bar mitzvahed, and then I was 14 when I first went along to a Buddhist centre. So there may well have been quite... I think there probably was quite a close connection. I basically did my bar mitzvah, and I realised I didn't believe a word of it. But I was still happy to do the bar mitzvah and be given all the fountain pens and, you know, money that kids get. Anyway, so there you go. So, where were we? Yes, the sila. Yeah, ethics. Problematic, isn't it? And that's why we don't, at Buddhist Centre, have a drop-in morality class. You know, we have a drop-in meditation class. And at the same time, we all know that how we act towards other people is so important. We know from our experience that in lots of areas of our life, the way that other people act affects us and can cause us tremendous suffering. And we also know that the way that we act and in relation to other people can cause them suffering. I mean, just think about your love life. You know? I'm not going to say any more. I don't need to, do I? Or other people's love lives and how much pain we cause each other through our actions. And that's not about any idea about what's right or wrong, you know, it's not about having a preconception about what's right and wrong that we're going to impose on. I'm going to say, well, you mustn't do that, you must do that. It's just that we then often make each other unhappy sometimes. So that's the realm of ethics. And the Buddhist teachings of ethics, the most basic formula, which we sometimes recite when we do pujas, is the five precepts. So the first of these precepts is not taking life. But there's a positive counterpart of that, which is loving kindness or compassion. And the moment we start talking about kindness or compassion, we're really in an ethical arena. So loving kindness, compassion, and not taking life, which really means not harming other people. Sangharakshita's interpretation of that is, that is actually the basis of all Buddhist ethics. The rest are just details. All the rest is detailed workings out of how we can avoid harming others and more positively act with kindness towards them. So that's the first precept. The second precept is not taking that which is not given, and practicing generosity. The third precept is avoiding sexual misconduct, which sounds, you know, oh no, what are they going to tell me to do now? But actually, it's really what I was talking about. You know, that how we, it means not harming other people in the domain of sex and relationships and so on, as best we can, and cultivating stillness, simplicity, and contentment. Then the fourth precept is avoiding untruthful speech, false speech, we say. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about speech and communication, and a slightly expanded version of the precepts, which we follow in the order, which is the 10 precepts. There are four of these, the four aspects of speech that we really need to think about. And and they've all got positive counterparts. So speaking in a way that's truthful, helpful, harmonious, and kindly. So speech, and then the final precept is avoiding intoxicants that cloud the mind and cultivating mindfulness or awareness. Now, the nerd count is about to go up here, the geek count. Actually, those precepts weren't original to the Buddha. The Jains follow four of those five precepts. Their fifth precept is to have no possessions. So the Buddha simply adopted that set of precepts, but he said, because these are for people who aren't monks or nuns, the fifth precept wasn't realistic, and in fact could only lead to hypocrisy. And what we need to look at is our minds. So he brought in a fifth precept. So although this is very important within Buddhism, and every Buddhist person in Asia knows the five precepts, it's not really distinctive to the Buddha's teachings. What's really distinctive takes us back to mindfulness. It's the so mindfulness and an awareness of our motivations, the mental states that underpin our actions. From one point of view, just thinking about, well, you should do this and you shouldn't do that, is really quite superficial, because it doesn't get down to why we do those things, or slightly more subtly, why we want to do those things. Slightly more subtly again, what are the mental states that are connected with those things? So our actions spring from our minds. They spring from our intentions and our states of mind. And the basic distinction that the Buddha made was, and he did say, you can really make quite a simple basic distinction within states of mind between states that are skillful and states that are unskillful. So skillful mental the unskillful mental states are quite easily encapsulated: craving, desire to grab hold of things; aversion, desire to push things away; and ignorance, desire to avoid facing up to the truth of our lives. So these are basic coping mechanisms that human beings have. No doubt there are all sorts of evolutionary reasons why we have them, but these pervade our normal experience: greed, hatred, and delusion. And that leads us to act unethically. Because we're insecure, we want things that are outside ourselves, so we want to grab hold of the things that we like. We want to push away the things we don't like. That very quickly leads us into unethical actions. You know, grabbing hold of the things we like means taking them. Pushing away the things we don't like means fighting them. So that this is very basic, but it's very important. And understanding ethics, therefore, means understanding our minds. Then the skillful things, that I started with the unskillful ones because they're quite simply expressed. The skillful things, actually, there are all sorts of different ways of talking about them, but simply put, they're the opposites of greed, hatred, and delusion. So a sense of going out to others with generosity, going out to others with kindness, and a willingness to see things for what they are. Now, so this is the basis of Buddhist ethics: skillful and unskillful. And, you know, in my view, this is really goes right to the heart of the Buddha's insight into the mind, into life. Skillful and unskillful, because it's not just they're not just two categories. One way the Buddha put it was to say, what we dwell upon becomes the inclination of the mind. So where we place our attention is what we become. If we have, if we dwell on thoughts of hatred, we become, that those tendencies become more and more strong. We become people who are more and more motivated by hatred. And conversely, if we dwell on compassion, we act it out, we make it real, and we cultivate it maybe through meditation, then that will become stronger. Putting that philosophically, we can say that the mind, in from the Buddhist point of view, isn't fixed, isn't stuck, it's conditioned. That's the philosophical way of putting it. Yeah. That mental states arise in dependence upon conditions. And what that means is our inner life, our minds, are an open sphere in which we can engage and we can become the person who will naturally act perfectly. So all of this means that we go from ethics into the mind, into the realm of the mind. But I went through those sort of increasingly subtle layers because I'm actually talking about mindfulness. In order to know what our motivations are, we need quite a lot of awareness. We need a sense of mental space. We need a perspective. We also need to be able to make distinctions. And we need to be able to make distinctions concerning our psychology in ways that don't mess us up psychologically. So it's quite easy to take this kind of skillful and unskillful, think that's basically good and bad, and if I'm finding myself meditating, but actually I'm thinking about sticking pins in someone, then that means I'm a bad person. So what happens then? Thinking I'm a bad person, looking at it in those terms, skillful and unskillful, is actually aversion. Okay? So it's quite easy to take ideas of ethics in ways that foster unskillful mental states. And from a point of view of Buddhist ethics, that's unethical. So we think we're being unethical, but we're being not ethical. You got me? You follow that? Yeah? In other words, it's subtle. And we need quite a lot of awareness of ourselves to really know how to... Well, we can start quite simply by you cultivate generosity by giving things to people, whether or not you feel like it, actually. But underneath that are all sorts of areas where we need mindfulness. We need awareness in order to know how to navigate this. How to make judgments without being judgmental. So that's probably enough on mindfulness and ethics. I'm just going to very briefly mention the other two layers of mindfulness. The second is of the second part of the path is samadhi, and I don't want to talk about this in a lot of detail, partly because we'll have a lot more opportunities to look at how mindfulness has a role within meditation, but also because I think this is very much the association that mindfulness has. It's sort of like meditating. But it helps to think about meditation, to step out of that other way of thinking about it, by thinking in terms of skillful and unskillful again. You know, with meditation, that's when we can become aware of these different forces within us. That's when we can be sensitively encouraging the skillful elements of our experience and finding how to work with the unskillful, unhelpful elements of our experience. So Sangharakshita describes meditation, defines meditation, as an uninterrupted flow of skillful mental states. And then the art of cultivating meditation is learning everything that that means. Yeah. So mindfulness is a very important part of meditation. It's not the same as getting concentrated. But you can be very concentrated and still be mindful. up to the third dhyana, you can be mindful. And then maybe something else happens. So then finally, prajna, that's the Sanskrit term. Panya is the Pali term for the third stage of the path, which it means wisdom or insight or understanding or knowing. And to understand that, we really need to consider the ways in which we lack insight, in which we actually are deluded, and we live in a way that is not in accord with reality. That's the fundamental. So my insight, wisdom, we talk about as seeing things as they really are. And it's really hard to do. It's not a thing you do, it's not a technique. But really seeing impermanence in our lives and taking it on and living in accordance with it. And really noticing the assumptions, the preconceptions that we bring to so many situations. Those are aspects of delusion. So mindfulness is the capacity to see things as they really are in a very simple way. At least it starts in a very simple way. You know, we feel the body as it really is. And we learn through practicing mindfulness to distinguish between that sort of direct experience and thinking about the body. Yeah? Same with our thoughts. do it in the right order. Our feelings. You know, to know our feelings for what they are, what we like, what we don't like, without mixing that all up in a big mush that's all about being caught up in our emotional responses to things. Seeing feelings as feelings. Seeing thoughts as thoughts. Seeing thoughts for what they really are. They might be true, they might not be true. And in a way, that is a mindfulness practice. And it's very much the realm of insight practice as well. Understanding how we interpret the world in a way that's a whole mix of feelings and thoughts and instincts and habits and all that. Learning to hold that more lightly, let it go, and to live more in accordance with reality. And now, which the Buddha says, you know, and Buddhists experience as being not just being terribly, terribly sensible and in a very boring way, you know, not having strong opinions about things or strong emotions, but really something terribly, tremendously liberating. So I've gone through those last two rather quickly, but we'll have plenty of time to come back to them. And I wanted to speak about ethics in particular, because I think ethics is the foundation of all of our lives, and is certainly the foundation of the path. If we're interested in meditation, if we're interested in mindfulness, we need to become aware and sensitive of how we are interacting with other people. How our actions impact on the world, how our minds shape our behaviour, and that's, I think, where we start with mindfulness, and that's also where I'm going to finish my talk.